The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
What else? And South Jersey, welcome to Inside Medicine. This is going to be our most robust one-hour program ever. We have Deepak Chopra coming on at the end of the hour. He is well-known and an individual who indicates that a practical guide to fulfillment of your dreams is necessary. Can you take action and change your thoughts? Can you believe in yourself? The flow, introspection, internal dialogue, and self-awareness and interchange, Whether you are healing from depression, heartache, illness, or just need to be led the right path, quotes from Deepak help you move past struggles, expand your heart, and take care of your body. The secret of attraction is to love yourself. Deepak Chopra will be with us at about 9:45. Next, we have a potential Nobel laureate, PhD Jack Trzewski. He is a quantum physicist and professor of oncology in the Department of Physics at the University of Alberta. He holds 5 U.S. patents and has published over 500 refereed journal papers. He's got nothing to do, I can see. 60 conference proceedings, 12 research monographs, and 20 book chapters. He has served on the editorial boards of 30 scientific journals and has been an associate editor of the Frontiers collection of the Spring Verlag in Hildeberg. My impression is we're going to be treated. Finally, we have my fellow New Jersey endocrinologist, Dr. Brian Fertig. Brian is an individual who, when you talk to him, you know he always goes to the base, always makes sure that things that are small are attended to, and he basically sees patients in the ICU day in and day out and basically probably is the best endocrinologist in the state of New Jersey. Let me just open up a second. Brian, give me some scoop. How are you doing today?
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. So let me just start off. You have a fantastic book here that you guys have wrote, Quantum Metabolism. Can you just help us for the audience? What is the definition of metabolism, which endocrinologists love to talk about?
Well, I think that metabolism is a misunderstood word that a lot of people may think of thyroid, weight loss, weight gain. But it comes from the Greek metabolismos, which means change. It's the totality of all chemical reactions in the body, and it ultimately comes down to energy. It's consumption, it's storage, it's production, it's utilization, and it's balance. Now, the metabolism is the distinguishing feature of a living system from a physical system. And that's a broad use of this term, but this is what something is able to metabolize. It's not alive. And when we talk about metabolic rate, we're referring to energy production and utilization. And so we define metabolic rate as the amount of energy produced per unit time.
So let me ask you this. So metabolism, you have a book out, which is phenomenal. It took you 5 years to write, Metabolism and Medicine, and Jack helped you out write that, The Physics of Biological Engines. So 5 years, lots of work. So can you just lead us on about what was in these two volumes, which are incredibly insightful?
Well, it's a broad range of topics in physics and medicine. The first volume looks at physics to understand biological systems, and this is where I had reached out to Jack. Initially, I reached out to this notion of quantum metabolism, which was incredibly intriguing to me, and it was coined by Lloyd Demetris. He's a Harvard mathematician, and I had reached out to him a few times. We went back and forth, and finally, I needed to understand this concept better because it was really at the root of what I believed was the flow of energy through biological systems, and I wanted to understand the term better because it was very much a part of the bigger picture that I was looking for. Ultimately, he emailed me and asked me if I would join him for lunch in Princeton. He'd be in Princeton, and I said I was more than delighted. And we went for lunch, and we had a nice 2-hour discussion. He described the concepts. I asked my questions. He was very he actually beat up on me initially and said, "You're a clinician. You're a doctor. You wouldn't have the intuitions. You go to the hospital and you see patients." I said, "Yes." I thought that was a good thing. He says, "You just proved my point. You don't have the right to you wouldn't have the intuitions to write about this and to understand it." But nonetheless, things settled down. We had lunch and we had a nice discussion at the end of it. He says, "Look, I'm only interested as far as the mathematics will take me. But I have a colleague who has written a number of these articles," and I've seen his colleague's name, Jack Dusinski, "who is interested in this, in the application to clinical medicine. Maybe Jack would be interested." So I reached out to Jack, and everything went from there. That was a beautiful, I owe him an enormous debt of gratitude, Lloyd, for introducing me to Jack, essentially. And Jack made that first volume happen, and that really was well over 5 years. I'd say 7 years to write the first volume because it took a lot of mentoring. And I was Jack's personal mentor. We spoke an hour a day for probably the first 1 to 2 years. And eventually we had spent enough time together that it was time to start writing and editing. And, I had 700 pages written by the time I reached Jack. So he had plenty to look over, but I'm sure it was very amateurish by his standards at the time. But we turned this into a poetic, beautiful writing, thanks to Jack and his incredible talent and his fortitude and his patience and love of teaching and seeing me evolve. So that manifests.
We're going to hear from this young man real soon, Jack. But I just want to move on a second because you guys have so much data here. Can you define what a healthy metabolism is, Brian?
Sure. Let me first describe what quantum metabolism is. So quantum, if the metabolism and metabolic rate is defined by the amount of energy produced per unit time, quantum metabolism is energy produced per unit time per mass over which this energy production is correlated for absolute synchronization and physiological perfection. In quantum metabolism, oxygen consumption is low, and metabolic efficiency and integration are maximal, which are the hallmarks of health. In quantum metabolism, or the quantum mode of energy production, this is the slowest form of metabolism or metabolic rate because of its maximum efficiency. So what defines a healthy metabolism is metabolic efficiency. This is defined by the amount of oxygen consumed per unit of energy produced per unit of time. So the lower the oxygen consumed, the greater the metabolic efficiency. Now, among energy substrates, let me finish this joke because this is important. The energy substrates that we eat, beta-hydroxybutyrate, the ketone bodies, are the cleanest burning fuel. They have the highest metabolic efficiency next to other fuels, such as glucose, which is a higher metabolic efficiency than fats. But in the process of energy production using this fuel, it causes the least oxidative stress, and it's the least damaging to the tissues. And there's the lowest amount of inflammation and associated heat. So it's very permissive for quantum metabolism to occur. Now, it has particular, it's got tantalizing promise for the future of medicine. It's particularly useful for the neurotrophic diseases or neurodegenerative diseases of the brain, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS, as well as cancers, even heart and vascular disease, and insulin resistance, diabetes related to insulin resistance, ADD, autism, seizure disorders in cognition. It's been used in the military for strength and stamina and as a performance enhancer in athletics, both physical and cognitive, for that mental focus. So finally, fasting is, every religion has a tradition of fasting, with the idea is that it brings mental clarity and brings you closer to God. So if free will is the expression of is the quantum biological expression of consciousness, then quantum metabolism is the bridge between free will and physiological perfection.
So Brian, let me just check in here 1 second. So you and I are both endocrinologists, do a lot of ICU work. You see DKA left and right. And isn't it interesting that in DKA, the body switches metabolism to ketones, which you say are incredibly effective and basically make a patient live longer. So those ketones, which we detect and need for insulin drips and rapid and saline infusion, basically you're saying that the body is smart enough to go to the right metabolite, the ketone bodies. Never heard that before. You are very insightful. Thank you.
Let me answer an important distinction. When you have a type 1 diabetic that goes into DKA, you're making ketone bodies, that's a pathological state. So that's very different than actually what I'm we can use ketones. I think diabetics type 1 that don't make enough insulin, and you need insulin to survive, when that insulin falls, the body's making ketone bodies because it's trying to survive. But those ketone bodies turn into a ketoacidosis. And acidosis, along with energy and oxidation status, or what we call redox, those are the three most fundamental parameters of human metabolism. And when you're acidotic from a result of ketosis, that's a very dangerous situation. So that's a metabolic decompensation. So a type 1 diabetic needs to be very careful when we're talking about the ketone bodies as a strategy for health. And we're also not there yet. It's a tantalizing future practice for the future of medicine, but there's danger in here, and there's several dangers at all tiers, whether you're talking about a ketogenic diet, you're talking about fasting strategies, you're talking about over-exercising or ketogenic supplements, such as, you know, esters and salts that we're not ready for prime time there. Those ketone bodies are, we don't know the optimal dose. What's the best timing? What's the formulation? Which form should we take? There's different sensitivities of different tissues, so we're not ready for prime time. So I don't want to oversell this for the current and think that it's categorically good, but it holds incredible promise for the future of medicine, and it is a hot topic in the field of metabolism.
So. Drilling down now, what accelerates aging in the human body? and I guess every other animal's system.
Yeah, well, with any chronic or exaggerated stress is going to accelerate aging, whether it's a psychogenic stress, but a poor quantity, quality, or timing of diet, sleep, or activity are all going to accelerate the aging process. But too little stress isn't good either, because you need this for resilience and cell signaling. And if for example, if you oversleep more than 8 hours a night, you increase the antioxidant. There's an upregulation of antioxidants, and you impair cell signaling and physiology. Same thing if you don't get enough phytonutrients or understimulation of social, cognitive, or physical activities. That also will impair cell signaling and physiology. So there's a hormesis. Too little or too much is toxic, but something intermediate is optimal, and that's at a very personalized scale.
So, Brian, you talked about emotional intelligence of a healthcare practitioner. Can you tell me what that means? Got to watch out for that answer.
Well, you know, let me first describe what consciousness is. It's related to intelligence. The consciousness of Sir Roger Penrose, the Nobel laureate in 2020, he described consciousness as an awareness of perspectives. It's an awareness of an awareness, the depth of awareness. It's about self-awareness, awareness of others. It's knowing how our motivations and free will are beneficial to ourselves and others, how they're perceived by others. So this awareness of perspectives, of information, Penrose describes as emotional intelligence, and it's necessary for understanding. By connecting the dots of these perspectives of information that generate or promote creative insights, that then is necessary for natural intelligence, which is real world application and problem solving for an individual. Now, when you're talking about emotional intelligence of an individual, it's of a healthcare practitioner. It's about having a robust and well-rounded awareness of information surrounding a medical topic, as well as of the patient, understanding the patient's fears and expectations, biases and belief systems, and so on, so that you can generate generate optimal problem solving and patient a satisfying experience for the patient. So, for example, an obese person will have a prescription of a certain lifestyle changes, particular lifestyle changes, with or without pharmacological agents, or which agents, and with or without a bariatric procedure, or which type. So this is, it's very unique to the individual, because there's no, you know, one size fits all for any patient in any scenario.
Got it. Can I just ask you one last question before we get to Jack?
Sure.
What are some examples of quantum biology in the application of clinical medicine?
Oh, that's a good question. Thank you.
You're in the ICU.
Yeah. Well, when I went to school growing up, you know, the most fundamental tier of medicine, of the life sciences, was always biochemistry. In the late 1990s, it was molecular biology. Now it's quantum biology. And with increasing interest and justification for the application of quantum biology to clinical medicine. Now, with microtubules, let's give some background here. Based on the Penrose-Hameroff model of consciousness, they appear vital for the storage and processing of consciousness at the quantum level from which emotional and natural intelligence emerge. While disturbances of these microtubules appear critical for the pathogenesis of chronic disease. Now, for example, tau is a microtubule-associated protein, and it becomes hyperphosphorylated in the setting of insulin resistance and insulin resistance-related diabetes and prediabetes. And loss of tau and microtubule disassembly leads to neurofibrillary tangles in Alzheimer's disease. And this represents a more promising approach for the management of Alzheimer's disease. Also, microtubules form mitotic spindles and centrioles in the cell-replicating processes of mitosis and meiosis. However, a disturbance of these quantum biological processes of orchestrated Bowie-like separation of chromosomes leads to genomic instability, gene mutations, and cancer cell development.
So that sounds good to me. I just want to move forward a second here because I got to get Jack on. So Jack Tuzewski, PhD, is a quantum physicist and professor of oncology in the Department of Physics at the University of Alberta. He holds 5 U.S. patents and has published over 500 refereed journals. I can't believe he sees his wife. He's done 60 conference proceedings, 12 research monographs, and 20 book chapters. My God. So Jack Tuzewski, welcome to Inside Medicine. You've got to be
thank you for inviting me.
So Jack, let me just ask, what's missing in the conventional explanations of brain physiology, and does the brain operate at a quantum level?
Well, in one word, a lot.
One word.
I mean, two words, actually. But I will try to address this question in more detail. But the big picture is, of course, consciousness. You know, where does it emerge in the human brain, animal brains, perhaps? I will not go too deep into consciousness because it's a separate topic for probably many hours, not just one. But specifically, as a physicist, I would say you can pin it down on 3 major areas, namely energy, time, and information, regarding to the functioning of the brain. And maybe I'll just start by quoting Sir Winston Churchill in a different context. He said, "It's a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, but perhaps there is a key." And that key, I think, in reference to the human brain, is quantum. That discussion was unleashed by Sir Roger Penrose that Brian mentioned. But why energy, time, information? First of all, the human brain is one of the most complex structures known to us in the universe. It is composed of about 100 billion neurons and other cells, and each neuron has about 10,000 synaptic connections, some up to 100,000 synaptic connections. Imagine this being a society of 100 billion individuals, each of which is constantly talking to 10,000 other individuals. That's the complexity. The energy aspect, as a physicist, to me, as a physicist, is mind-boggling because, pun not intended, because the human brain operates at a power rating of about under 100 watts, which is equivalent to an incandescent bulb's and power requirement, and about 95% of all of that is just to maintain temperature and structure. Repairing proteins and so on. And about 5% is for information processing. So let's say 5 watts, that's comparable to a flashlight. That's what we use for our cognitive abilities, our cognitive processes, our playing chess, solving problems, talking to you, driving a car, and doing a lot of things simultaneously. That is, for me, the mind-boggling aspect. And these days, you can hear a lot about supercomputers and the power of artificial intelligence and so on. But for comparison, supercomputers that play chess with humans and sometimes win, they use 1.5 megawatts, which means a million times more than the human, roughly speaking, than the human brain for a similar process. And we do other things at the same time. So that, to me, is the first mystery. The second mystery is, if I have time, is time, actually. Because there's examples of how our responses to stimuli, which basically defy conventional neurophysiology. We respond, some of the top athletes perform feats of accomplishments on millisecond timescales. Let's say returning a serve going at 100 miles an hour. It takes maybe a couple milliseconds to perfectly return it by somebody like Djokovic. And yet, when you do calculations based on the rates of transmission of these signals through the nerves and into the brain and then reaction to it, triggering the muscle action, it would be at least 500 milliseconds typically for such a reaction time. So that we don't know how to address this question. The third one, which to me actually is equally profound, is integration of all the sensual inputs and perceiving the world around us as one. We hear, hear the sound, see the images, and touch somebody, and all of this somehow miraculously arrives at the same time. We have a singular perception of the world, not five different sensual inputs, and then we somehow scramble to find out how it all fits together. So that's that. And then on the information aspect, where is memory at the molecular level? We don't know where memory is stored. What is it? I mean, it has to be, in my opinion at least, at the molecular level, some molecules must carry this information and store it somewhere. Where is it? We propose some answers to these questions, but this is my very quick run through these issues. And maybe just on a different level, there's also some phenomenological aspect of our neurophysiology, which are very difficult to explain. Things like premonitions or sensing being watched by someone or having dreams that foretell the future, this kind of thing, which is very hard to explain, except sometimes, you know, if you involve quantum mechanics, these answers may be easier to achieve than using classical physics or physiology. Okay, so that's...
Jack, let me ask you something. Well, just to interrupt, I'm sorry. So basically, sure. I think some of this information indicates that some of the information that's stored in our brains came from past people that we knew. Does that sound to you interesting or true? Is there information
yes.
that is sent to us that we didn't even experience, but we know about and adapt to?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. You know, this is, of course, a bit speculative, but I think if you invoke quantum field theory, which is kind of the most modern version of quantum mechanics, then, of course, you would think about the brain, the human brain, as creating its own quantum field, and these fields may interact with other fields, other people's, especially brain, especially which are people that are emotionally connected to us. I thought about performing such experiments, actually. That can be demonstrated, in my opinion, quite strongly. Yes, and then if we're in the lingo of quantum mechanics, you call it entanglement, that we may be entangled through these quantum fields with other people. And by the way, Nobel Prize in Physics a year ago in 2022 was given to three physicists who demonstrated quantum entanglement in physical entities, electrons and photons and other particles. But I think that that process of entanglement can expand to living systems. And that's the frontier of science, in my opinion, for the next decade or two.
So what would you say are your main messages in the book Quantum Body or Quantum Metabolism?
Well, so that's the book that just came out December 5th in collaboration with Deepak Chopra and Brian Fertig, and that was a real fun thing to do, because we managed, I think, to weave together three different perspectives. Probably this is unique. The first one is, of course, the physical perspective, kind of nuts and bolts, you know, how physics can explain various processes in the human body. Then the second perspective is medical, at a higher level of organization. And the third perspective that especially, you know, Deepak Chopra contributed tremendously through his wisdom is spiritual and philosophical perspective. So the message, the main message in this book is that the human body is actually integrated and synchronized. And we believe that this synchronization, integration of various, not only tissues and organs and cells at the lowest level of organization, but the entire human body is synchronized by quantum processes, and that's why the title Quantum Body. There is no other explanation, to my opinion, at least at present, by, you know, kind of deterministic classical philosophy or even the philosophy of science, where we are talking about, you know, billiard balls hitting, you know, and then triggering something else. So the quantum perspective allows you for a global, integrated, synchronized functioning of the human body. And as Brian mentioned earlier, if some of these parts of the human body get desynchronized, as for example is the case with neurodegenerative diseases or with cancer, then you can probably even measure it in terms of metabolic rates, which become less efficient and are becoming a hallmark of desynchronization and kind of a rebellious behavior of these parts of the human body that that do not synchronize through the quantum integration. But in terms of specific messages, because the book is, as I said, it's composed of different and different perspectives. In terms of the specific perspective of physiology and human health, Brian mentioned already sleep. You know, respecting the chronobiology, another Nobel Prize recently given to in medicine a few years ago, respecting the time for different things, proper diet, and Brian mentioned that microbiota play a major role, sleep and stress reduction. And one thing that I just want to mention in this connection where physics can help us understand better some of these things is stress reduction by networking and being connected to other individuals, other you know, members of your family, friends, social networks, because this is a bit like distributing a load among mechanical parts, you know, and therefore reducing the pressure on a structure being our body. So this is very healthy, and physics can shed light on this. So
I guess that's one of the reasons going the other way is anybody who was put in isolation, if they were a prisoner in a black room with nobody else, I guess that is incredibly debilitating to a human brain. Any comment from your side?
Yeah, this is a great example. I haven't thought about it, but it's absolutely true that is an unbearable pressure on us. I think if you're isolated, we have nobody to share our problems with, discuss our, you know, joys and achievements and things of this nature. So yes, I think physics can provide this kind of perspective. We also with Brian, I think we provide another perspective on the human health, which is, we call it the physiological fitness landscape, which is kind of going a little bit away from the traditional, you know, assessing of the vital signs on the blood work results, tests, and so on, just looking whether you're in the accepted normal range or outside the range. We propose something better than that, I think, which is basically creating a multidimensional landscape of, within the space of these parameters and seeing how we move through it in a trajectory rather than points. And this is a bit like creating a GPS for the human health. So that's our kind of vision for the future. And maybe one day we'll be able to implement this in a GPS for our human body, which will be a wearable device maybe. And everybody can see where they are at in terms of their health and how they can improve it.
Can I just ask you one last question? What's the difference between quantum physics and classical physics, and does it matter?
Right. Okay, this is a one-semester course in physics, but I'll try to answer your question in one minute. Well, the main difference is that in classical physics, we think about objects having specific locations, masses, and points in space, and particular time-dependent movement. In quantum physics, this becomes obsolete. The particles or objects in general don't have specified location. They are more like clouds, and they also interpenetrate as clouds, and this is, by the way, this cloud interpenetration is the nature of the chemical bond. All chemical bonds are quantum in nature, so that's one example. And then, of course, there's the question of indeterminism, which is a philosophical departure from the 300-year-old tradition of thinking that everything is predictable. If you know the equations, initial conditions, you can predict the future. In quantum mechanics, everything is probabilistic. You can only say about, what's the probability of something happening, the odds, but you cannot say this will happen for sure. This is, in my opinion, of incredible importance, even in regard to things like artificial intelligence, which we tend to kind of religiously believe as a panacea for all our problems, but quantum mechanics is very skeptical about things like that. So that's one-minute answer to your question, but if you want more, and then we can have a three-hour discussion.
Okay. Well, Doctor, I really think you have added a lot to mankind's effort, and I do hope one day, because I know you've been up for a Nobel Prize, that they grant it to you, and thank you for making mankind better. So move on to our last guest, and that is somebody by the name of Deepak Chopra. Dr. Chopra is an endocrinologist, believe it or not, but he has gone way farther, and he hits things like healing from depression, heartache, illness, loss. He's an individual who makes sure that people get the most out of their life in a positive way. Dr. Chopra, thank you for hopping on to Inside Medicine.
Not sure that maybe Deepak hasn't dialed in yet. We said 10:40 would be.
So Brian, let me just get back to you, okay? Because I know he's over in California. So Brian, where do you think endocrinology is going? Because you practice in that ICU every day, you help patients, you're very intuitive, and you kind of get to the bottom line as opposed to being just touching the top. Where do you think endocrine is going right now, especially because you're a super ICU endocrinologist?
Thank you, Joe. I think that we have a very compartmentalized system of medicine where, the tissues and the organ systems don't have their own separate parking lots. It's an incredibly integrated system of biology that that guides our health and disease. And so it's important to understand the contextual nature of all these things. And we have to be careful in the interventions because what sounds intuitive is not always the case. For example, you're starving and let's force feed, let's give, you're talking about the ICU, you want to put an NG tube or something and give the person feeding hyperal one way, shape or another. Now, maybe the body just knows better than we know. Is it through our arrogance that we know better, or should we respect the infinite wisdom of biological system that's evolved for millions of years? It knows that starvation may be the key. Maybe it's generating ketosis, and that's how it survives. But flooding with calories is not it turns out it increases mortality. So the body did turn out to know better. In setting of cancer, maybe we lose an appetite for a reason. And because we know that fasting, you fast, and at least in animal models, you fast an animal for 24 to 48 hours before chemo or radiation treatment. And then 24 hours after, you increase the response to the chemo radiation treatment double. So you double the response with half the dose. So the effect of fasting is important. But in any event, so Jack and I have developed a model. It's called the Physiological Fitness Landscape Model. And it's able to predict and prevent the onset of chronic disease before it's too late. And it'll also predict the patient response to therapeutic interventions. So it can show a trajectory, and we can change it. You know, we input this data that plots the trajectory of your health, of any domain of your health, and then allows us options to change that directory, that trajectory before it's too late. So I just think that's incredibly powerful. I mean, there's much more to this. I have a 15-minute condensed version just to describe this, which I recently presented. Many forums presented this, but it's Jack and I plan to write a book just on this topic, because we think it's a game changer for healthcare, and it's got incredible transformative potential to move not only health lifespan, but health span, which corresponds with lifespan, to approach maximum human lifespan, which is probably somewhere around 117 years for most people. So we call it 120, the 120-year lifespan. But so if that becomes the average human lifespan and health span, because they track together, and imagine the cost savings. There's somebody that dies at the age, a centenarian, compared to it, somebody who dies at the age of 70, the cost of healthcare in the last 2 years of life is 30% less for a centenarian than somebody who dies at the age of 70. And, you know, if you're going to live well into your hundreds, would 105 be the new 65, and imagine the additional years of vitalizing work and productivity. You know, it's what that does for your soul and what it does for medicine, and it just takes the stress of worrying about loved ones, worrying about health, and work, and living your life, living in the present, and saving money at the same time. So that's the next tier that Jack and I venture over the next year. So
Brian, Deepak's on, so I'm just going to move on. Don't want to be nasty, but we just want to get him in. Deepak, perfect. Thank you for coming on Inside Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
You're an incredibly productive individual who gets things done and helps many people, and you accelerate that exponentially by your books. So can I ask you, do you want to open up a little bit and say what Deepak Chopra is all about and how his publications have been influential in making people live longer and better?
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I'm very privileged to be an author with Jack and Brian, two amazing scientists and physicians. Brian is, of course, a fellow endocrinologist, and Jack is an amazing scientist and a quantum biologist, which is a very new discipline. And, you know, Brian's expertise in quantum metabolism has added a lot to this book. My background also is endocrinology and neuroscience and neuroendocrinology. And I was involved in the early research in the 70s and early 80s on what we now know are called neuropeptides, so neurochemicals. that also act as immunomodulators. So everyone now knows the names of things like serotonin, opiates, oxytocin, dopamine, anandamide. But in the 70s, we were just realizing that these were the molecules of emotion. And this led me to what later was called mind-body medicine, and then integrative medicine. And now the whole science, as you've been listening to Brian, of longevity and health span. So, you know, my background also includes Eastern wisdom traditions, in addition to the great scientific expertise of my collaborators that made this book very interesting, because in Eastern wisdom traditions, you don't count your life in the number of years you live, but in the number of breaths that you take in a lifetime, or at the number of heartbeats. And there's a saying in Eastern wisdom traditions, time is the consumer and we are its food. So, you know, these days everybody's kind of rushing around and totally out of time. Their internal dialogue says, I have no time. I have no time to do this. I have no time to do that. If your internal dialogue says you have no time, then your biological clock speeds up. You have a faster heart rate, jittery platelets, inflammation, heart rate variability gets lower. And if you suddenly drop dead of heart attack, then of course you've run out of time. So, you know, the value of mindfulness, being in the present moment, as Brian was saying earlier, actually doesn't matter how busy you are, as long as your quality of presence is there in the moment. It doesn't matter what you're doing. It's only anticipating the future and regretting the past or being burdened by the so-called construct of time that influences to a great deal how we age. So my interest in quantum metabolism began a long time ago when one day, mistakenly, I told a patient, I was reading the wrong chart. I told a patient that he had cancer, and I could see immediately how his demeanor changed, his body language changed, his blood pressure went up, inflammatory markers went up. And then a few hours later, I realized that I'd made a mistake, that it wasn't his chart, it was somebody else. And immediately he changed again, which I realized then was information or interpretation of information changing his metabolism. Now we know that every experience changes genetic activity, especially emotional experiences change genetic activity through on-off switches. Something that we now call epigenetics. So our emotional state and our mental states influence our metabolism moment by moment. The science part was, you know, very much a contribution of Brian and Jack, and that's all I have to say. I'm just thrilled to be a co-author with these two amazing scientists and doctors.
Well, they also give you a lot of feedback too in positivity, Dr. Chopra. Let me ask you: can you just comment on the seven spiritual laws of success? Everybody wants to be a success, but what are your insight is a little bit deeper. The seven spiritual laws of success.
Well, that was a book that influenced a lot of people, and that was based on fundamentally understanding consciousness as the fundamental reality which leads to all experience. And in that book, I define success as the progressive realization of worthy goals, the ability to have love and compassion, and most importantly, to get in touch with your creative center. The first spiritual law is the law of pure potentiality, which says that pure consciousness is the immeasurable potential of all that was, all that is, and all that will be. And you get in touch with that creative center through mindfulness, meditation, and getting to the source of all experience through transcendence. The second law is the law of giving and receiving. Whatever you want in life, learn to give. The third law is karma, which means every action has an effect. And therefore, just remember that good actions lead to good results. and actions that are hurtful lead to unfortunate results. Karma never forgets an address. The fourth law is the law of least effort. When you're grounded in being, then you do less and accomplish more. And that is maximum efficiency. Instead of hard work driving plans and hard work driving ambition and exacting plans, if you actually get in touch with the source of all experience, which is consciousness, you learn to do much more with least effort. The next law is the law of intention, which says that when you're grounded in being, intention organizes the soul fulfillment. And the sixth law is the law of detachment, which says be process-oriented instead of outcome-oriented. And the final law is the law of dharma, which is purpose and meaning in existence, which gives you fulfillment.
So can I thank you very much? Can I ask you just to jump 1 second? Quantum Metabolism, your new book. How does that dovetail in what your previous, works have done? The 7 spiritual laws of success is an example. How did quantum metabolism come in from your perspective?
See, metabolism is influenced by every experience we have: eating, breathing, digestion, metabolism, elimination, sensory experience, thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, imagination, our personal social interactions. This is what happens in a 24-hour period. This is what we experience. And every one of these experiences influences how we metabolize not just food, but all experience, including the experience of time. So quantum metabolism, I'm not that much of an expert as Brian is. He's written 2 amazing volumes on quantum metabolism. But basically, the new science of epigenetics tells us that less than 5% of disease is connected to what are called fully penetrant genes, which means genes that guarantee disease, like the BRCA gene, for example. Even for that now, over the horizon, we have new technologies coming, such as gene editing, messenger RNA. And of course, we also have now the ability to influence our microbiome, which is 2 million extra genes in addition to the 25,000 human genes. So through changing the quality of our experiences, we can upgrade the activity of human genes, but through various means, including vagal stimulation, diet, and social interactions, and breathing, and yoga, and meditation, we can also influence the epigenome, which is basically 95% of our diseases is related to lifestyle causes. And through diet, a diet that has maximum diversity of organic foods and plant-based foods, we can change the microbiome. So the future of well-being is very bright right now with the combination of modern technologies, including gene editing, messenger RNA, epigenetics, the new science on nutrition and parasympathetic nervous stimulation. I think in the long run, as the next few years unfold, we will see that chronic disease becomes optional and one can live a healthy, long life.
So you sound to me like you're incredibly biologically young. Anything special that you do that makes you this durable? And I'll say adorable too, but I'm just going to stick with adorable.
Well, listen, I'm 77, but yes, I'm biologically young. I have no illness. I don't take any medication. I practice yoga regularly. I exercise regularly. I'm good about my diet and I sleep well. And I have no resentments or grievances. So I make sure that my life is one of empathy, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And I think that's something anyone can enjoy.
So can I just ask you to give a final statement about your new book? Because I think it's got a lot of readers that need to read it.
Well, for all those who are interested in mind-body medicine, integrative health and well-being, and longevity, I think this is a book that combines wisdom traditions and their insights with very, very cutting-edge insights from quantum biology, thanks to Jack, and also quantum metabolism, thanks to Brian.
So, Dr. Chopra, thank you for hopping on Inside Medicine. This podcast will be up in 20 minutes. www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine, and then you can pick your podcast. I want to thank my three guests, who are individuals who make the world better, and I anticipate more from them. Thank you very much. Joe Fallon signing
thank
off.
You.
Next week back.
WWDBAM is an equal opportunity employer and is dedicated to performing broad outreach.